This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So what's the chance the average American will experience poverty in their lifetime? A group of researchers at the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center study these kinds of questions all the time. They look for trends in demography. And if you're not a population trends researcher yourself, the answer found about poverty is bound to surprise you. Apparently, there's about a 50-50 chance that most any of us could find ourselves falling below the poverty line at some point in our lives. This finding comes on the heels of another new report released by Weldon Cooper. This study shows that more than 40% of Virginia households are currently using some aspect of the social safety net designed to help the poor. So just what is the social safety net? How well is it working? Who's using it? The answers here may surprise you too when we meet our guests from the Weldon Cooper Center right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Poverty and the status of the social safety net in Virginia are the topics of our focus today. If you have thoughts to share about those issues or questions to ask, you can reach us by phone at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Here with me, Dustin Cable, co-author of a new study titled Virginia and the Social Safety Net, published by the Demographics and Workforce Section of the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center. And sitting next to Dustin, Meredith Strom Gunter, Director of Outreach for that Workforce Section at Weldon Cooper. Thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be back.
So why this new study at this point in time? Dustin?
So during this election cycle, we hear a lot of talk from everyone, left and right, about public debt. We hear a lot also about the social safety net, those programs like food stamps and unemployment insurance. So we want to do a study that responds to a lot of the misconceptions people have about the social safety net and low-income individuals in general. So when we first started out, we wanted to take a in-depth look into poverty in Virginia. And when we're talking about poverty, we're talking about less than $22,000 a year for a family of four. So we're looking at poverty in Virginia, and we see that Virginia statistics actually look pretty good on the face. We have high employment, and we have a low poverty rate compared to the nation. But when we dig deeper, we see a lot of disparities regionally and across different demographic groups. So the face of the poor population in Virginia is still mostly white. However, we do see that a lot of minority groups are overly represented. For instance, the poverty rate among African Americans is almost 1 in 5. And the poverty rate among Hispanics is 12.5%, while we see the poverty rate much lower among whites and Asians.
And we've taken a look at what's happening regionally with poverty, too, in Virginia. And
well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because Dustin just said that you use the national metric, which is currently a family of four making less than $22,000 a year. It occurs to me that it's probably much more expensive for a family of four to live somewhere around Fairfax or Arlington in Northern Virginia than the same family of four trying to get by in Farmville, isn't it?
No, absolutely, Tom. And actually, even taking that single metric of $22,000 a year for a family of four and applying it across the state, our statewide rate is about 10.8% in poverty. But it ranges, using that one metric, from 3 to 30%. So just even the single metric will give you a wide range depending on where people live. And then if you start to look at adjusting the measure for costs of living in areas, you get significantly different numbers. So we think that one of the things we do, particularly in the first part of the poverty series, is to look at some of the weaknesses of the federal poverty measure as a measure in and of itself, that one measure across all localities doesn't make sense, and that actually many of those who live what we call near poverty also are as much in need as those who are in poverty.
What's the measure for near poverty?
Well, it's usually defined as 150% of the federal poverty line. So
we're talking about a family of four making less than $33,000 a year.
Yeah, about that. And it's important to remember too, that this poverty measure is not a measure of what it takes to get by, to make a living, to function in society. It's more of a measure of deprivation. And it's been a useful measure since the 1960s in measuring deprivation using one metric, one static metric, a common measure across the entire United States.
Well, Dustin, you said that your findings show that in one way, Virginia seems to be doing quite well, perhaps in part because historically Virginia's unemployment rate stays lower than the national average, and many economists attribute that to all the federal government spending, all of the federal government, both direct government jobs and contracted jobs that take place in Virginia that perhaps keep the state's unemployment rate artificially low. But I had a couple of questions for you about that idea that in one way we're doing reasonably well. One is, do you have a sense of how Virginia compares to other places in the country when it comes to the degree of poverty, the numbers of people in poverty, whether you're comparing us to Alabama, Minnesota, New York, California? Do we have kind of a ranking compared to other states in the country?
Well, in our work as demographers, we often speak of this phenomenon called the two Virginias. So we have Northern Virginia and the rest of the Commonwealth. Of course, the story is a little more complicated than that, but you can actually explain a lot of things that way. So the reason that we have a high employment and lower poverty rate has a lot to do with Northern Virginia, exactly those government jobs that you were describing. But we also see tremendous variation across the state. And Meredith was mentioning this before. We see a low of 3% poverty rate in Falls Church, and we see a high of 30% in some areas of Southwest Virginia. So when we compare ourselves to other states in the nation, I mean, depends on what Virginia you're talking about. If you're talking about Southwest Virginia, then we have a lot in common that with the poverty that we see in parts of West Virginia, parts of North
Carolina. Appalachia.
Exactly. So when we're making comparisons, it's not only important to look at the state level, and it's important to remember, too, that Virginia still is doing well. Let's not forget that. But still, we have to look deeper into some of these regional variations that we're seeing.
Meredith, Dustin is a researcher, and although I've read his reports, and for the most part, they're pretty easy for a layman like me to read who doesn't know much about statistics and population trends. I understand that your job as the director of outreach is to take some very complicated research findings and to translate them into terms that most anybody can understand. So let me ask you about this second part that I think was hinted with Dustin's original statement of, in one way, we're looking pretty good. Are there other ways in which you, having looked at this research, can say that Virginia may not be doing so well?
Oh, sure. It concerns me, for example, that 17% of Virginians live in or near poverty. So when you start talking about those people who live at 150% of the federal poverty line, we're talking about almost a fifth of Virginians that are either living in or near poverty. And that's of concern, of course. And for children, the childhood poverty rate in Virginia is 14%. That's the highest for all age groups. And I think when we think about the legacy of poverty and the impact that it can have in the lives of children, that's a significant concern from a policy point of view.
Why is the poverty rate, both in Virginia and I think nationwide, so much higher among children than any other age group?
Well, poor families tend to, and this is just a tendency, they tend to have more children than more affluent families. And that's why part of the reason why we see higher numbers. Meredith was mentioning before, too, that we do see childhood poverty is particularly concerning because we do see some long-term effects with it. So if a family ever falls below poverty, those children do experience scientifically proven negative outcomes. They have poor cognitive development. They experience greater degrees of social isolation, poor health outcomes. And over the course of their lifetimes, this can translate into lower educational attainment, lower income, and a greater risk of falling into poverty again.
We have here our first question coming in on our Facebook page, which is listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. This is from Ron, and he brings up something we haven't touched on yet. He says, healthcare services are also an important public good or part of the safety net, and all residents, poor or rich, should have access to the services without being bankrupted. Affordable access is a fact of life in most, if not all, of other civilized countries. There isn't really a question there, but let me take it to the question that I was planning to ask the two of you. Do you have a sense of how healthcare reform has already, from the parts of it that have already gone into law, affected poverty in Virginia? And if it stays constitutional and the full effect of the reform goes into law in 2014, do you have a sense of whether it's going to make a significant difference in one way or another?
There are there are two passes at this. Dustin also authored a paper not too long ago about Medicaid, and he'll talk about that in a minute and the difference that has made. But one of the issues with the federal poverty line that we've been talking about is the fact that it's based on food costs. It was developed in 1969, and it was based on triple the estimate of the food pyramid, eating at the food pyramid, developed in 1969, and really hasn't changed in basic structure since. And yet other costs have gone up, medical costs for families being a significant one as a proportion of household budgets. So if we're able to provide any help for families in terms of their medical and healthcare costs through healthcare reform or other measures, we're going to make a difference in the economic well-being of families.
And Meredith made a good point. She said economic well-being of families, because the official poverty measure actually doesn't include those resources like Medicare or Medicaid. It only accounts for cash income.
It also does not account for how much families spend on health care.
So the Census Bureau actually has a new measure out there called the Supplemental Poverty Measure that the Bureau has been experimenting with, and that actually does include the health care cost factor into their poverty measurement directly.
One significant change as a result of the Health Care Act is the item on Medicaid. Dustin, you want to describe the Medicaid eligibility change?
Right. If healthcare holds, in 2014, we'll see an expansion of Medicaid up to pretty much everyone underneath 133% of the poverty line. This was something that was recently debated, I think, on Wednesday by the Supreme Court, whether it was constitutional or not. But some of the things that are in place right now, such as children being able to stay on their parents' health care insurance up until the age of 26, we are seeing some impacts of that.
Well, one of the most significant changes you pointed out in that paper that I found so fascinating, Dustin, was the childless adults who are in poverty or near poverty are able to get benefits as a result of the change in the health care law, right?
So before the health care reform, many adults who didn't have children, who were not disabled, and who were not elderly were completely ineligible for these low-income programs, particularly Medicaid. But now with health reform, they're able to obtain health insurance.
Ron, thank you for your question on Facebook. And to you on the other side of your radio, is there something about Virginia's social safety net that is especially important to you? Some element of dealing with poverty or efforts to get out of poverty that you'd like to discuss? Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. And once again, you can also reach us through Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Our conversation with Meredith Gunter and Dustin Cable from the Weldon Cooper Center at the University of Virginia, and the Weldon Cooper Center's new report on poverty across the Commonwealth. That conversation continuing in just a bit more than 1 minute. Meredith Strom Gunter is a former special advisor to Virginia Governor Jerry Beliles, a former special projects provost at Radford University, and even a former dorm mother at Virginia Commonwealth University. But for many years now, Dr. Gunter has served as director of outreach for a special research group at the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center. Dustin Cable is one of the researchers at that group, officially called the Demographics and Workforce Section. Last year, he also served as a special advisor on political redistricting to current Governor Bob McDonnell. But Mr. Cable is here with us today, primarily because he is co-author of a new statewide study called Virginia and the Social Safety Net. If you have questions or comments, we'd be happy to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. This, as you probably know, is Virginia Insight, and I'm Tom Graham. And Dustin, not everybody is clear on what the term social safety net means.
So when we're talking about the social safety net, we're talking about two groups of programs. We're talking about those large social insurance programs like Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, and we have these group of programs called means-tested programs. These are the programs that target low-income individuals. That's Medicaid, food stamps, TANF, supplemental security income. So it's important to remember that the social safety net is not just for poor people. And in fact, the largest programs in terms of sheer participation and the amount of money that we spend, the largest are these big social insurance programs, Social Security and Medicare, that target the elderly population, whether you're low income or not.
And people often confuse Medicare and Medicaid.
Right. Medicare is that health insurance program that provides care for senior citizens age 65 and above. And Medicaid is that program that targets low income individuals.
So from what you're saying, the social safety net includes a lot of people who are receiving benefits from Medicare, receiving benefits from Social Security, but are not by any means considered poor.
Correct. That's absolutely true. And not only that, we do have unemployment insurance that's part of the social safety net. These are people who, because of the recent recession, have been unemployed and are collecting these benefits. A lot of them would never consider themselves to be poor individuals. They're just having a rough period in their careers, and they need these benefits to make it.
And Social Security disability income would be another example. So people who have been – who are disabled for any reason, or in the case of some workman's comp programs, people who are injured while they're on the job, those programs are all serving people who didn't anticipate it, haven't really done anything to get themselves in the circumstance that they're in, but need some help in the present to continue to be able to find ways to support themselves.
Is it true, though, Meredith, that Social Security created in the 1930s and Medicare created in the 1960s were created primarily because of concern about poverty, particularly poverty among the elderly?
Absolutely. And that, in part, was as people watched the earlier generation age. It became a concern that people were not going to have the resources because of the effects of the war and the amount of time that the Depression had people out of work, that there was not going to be enough economic resources to carry people into old age.
Is there any information available or any way to speculate on of these great number of people across Virginia and I guess across the U.S. who avail themselves of Medicare today and avail themselves of Social Security today who would be poor if they didn't have access to those programs?
Right. A lot of research goes into studying how many people would be poor if we didn't have these programs. It is a very difficult thing to research because we can never really truly know what the poverty rate would be in the absence of government intervention. But we do have a few clues, and we alluded to some of those clues in the reports that we recently published, and that these programs actually do provide a very important income source for a great number of Virginians.
Some people would say Social Security shouldn't be considered a part of a safety net because people pay into it. And most Social Security recipients just think, well, I'm getting the money back that I pay into it. But that's not entirely accurate.
Social Security and a lot of the programs attached to Social Security, like Medicare, are inherently progressive in the way that are designed, meaning that a low-income individual, all the money that they put into the system throughout their entire lives, they're actually going to get more back from these programs when they retire, versus a higher-income individual will actually receive less than what they put in.
So, really? Because it seems to me I've heard some economists who've been on the show before say that the average Social Security recipient is getting in their lifetime these days somewhere around 2.5 to 3 times what they put in terms of the contributions to the program that they made from their payroll tax.
This is a situation where averages can lie. We have to look at the entire economic spectrum. So we have to look at how much money low-income individuals are receiving and how much money the higher-income individuals are receiving from and what they put in throughout their entire lifetimes. And we particularly see this progressivity in the Social Security disability insurance that people receive, because it is the disabled populations that tend to be the low-income individuals as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit then about the programs that are specifically for people who fall below the poverty line, which, as you mentioned, for a family of four would be less than $22,000 a year in income.
And Tom, before we go down that path, let me just point out that falling below the federal poverty line is not something that a family or a household falls below that poverty line and stays there for the rest of their futures. And in fact, some recent work that's been done and that you pointed out in the lead into the show is that through the working age years, 1 in 2 Americans will at some point have annual incomes less than the poverty line at least once. And the people cycle in and out of what we might call poverty, which really means earning less than that federal poverty line for whatever their family structure is, sometimes many times over their lifetime. So when we think of the poor population, we tend to think about the sort of chronic poor, the pictures of the, you know, the folks in the cabin in Appalachia or the, you know, the inner city poor. But actually many people have the experience of relying on social safety net programs in and out during the course of their lifetime. So I just want to set that as a context before we talk more about the uptake of those programs.
And I should mention again for anybody who wants to join the conversation here with our guests from the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center, the phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. We do have some more Facebook posts that I will get to in a moment, but as you may be able to tell, my voice is still hinky. So I would much appreciate anybody who wants to join in by adding their voice to the conversation so that I won't have to do so much reading of other people's thoughts. On the issue of poverty programs specifically or social safety net programs specifically for the poor, Dustin, we've got TANF, which used to be called welfare. We've got food stamps, which is now called something else, I guess.
Supplementary
SNAP.
Yeah,
Supplemental SNAP. Nutrition Assistance Program.
So, and there are some others. Pick one or two that you think are most important and give us an update.
By far the largest and most expensive program for low-income individuals is Medicaid. The costs are rising because of rising healthcare costs. But the costs are rising also because we do have this baby boom population that's growing. And a lot of the cost factor in Medicaid is due to the elderly. They're expensive to treat. And we also have the disabled that are in Medicaid, and they're also expensive. But we do have a lot of children and younger adults that are in Medicaid right now, but they contribute much, much less to the cost of that program.
And many of these means-tested programs do have not only income thresholds, but children as a target and families with children as a target population.
So when you say means-tested, what you mean is that
you can't get the program unless you make a minimum, you know, unless you're below a ceiling amount of money that you can earn. So you're not eligible for it unless you fall below the federal poverty line or some percentage of the federal poverty line. And children are in a lot of those programs. I mean, the school lunch program, for example, which provides free and reduced price lunches to kids from families who meet the means test. You
know, speaking of children, I've just been informed that we have an old friend of the show who's called in from Richmond and works a lot on children's issues. Margaret Nimmo Crow, thank you so much for joining us on Virginia Insight.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I'm guessing that you might have a question or comment for Meredith Gunter and or Dustin Cable.
Well, I was so excited when I heard that this was the topic for today, and thank you for covering it. And I just wanted to pick up with what you all were saying about the effect on kids and children who grow up in poverty and the long-term consequences of that. And I also just wanted to sort of, in a timely way, point to the state budget process that is going on right now, slowly but surely.
And your organization, by the way, is Voices for Virginia's Children?
Absolutely. Voices for Virginia's Children is a statewide child advocacy organization. We are involved in trying to influence the General Assembly and other policymakers to do the right thing by kids. And they're making some decisions right now that are going to
happen. Let me just mention that it is a very highly regarded organization in the General Assembly and in the nonprofit sector. I can't tell you the number of state lawmakers who have said wonderful things about your group. So.
Oh, well, thank you so much. We appreciate that. We try and be fact-based, and we rely a lot on the Weldon Cooper Center, so we thank you for that information. I just wanted to name a couple other programs that are being considered right now in the budget process that have a great impact on kids and their ability to get out of poverty. SNAP, the food stamp program, has already been mentioned. But also the Virginia Preschool Initiative is a very important initiative to get vulnerable kids into preschool so that when they get to kindergarten, they're ready to learn. They're not behind their peers already. Kids who start out behind tend to end up behind and are much more likely to drop out of school and have school failure. And that leads to all sorts of consequences, not only for the child, but for us as taxpayers having to pay for that. And right now, the Senate and the House are debating putting additional money in VPI, the Virginia Preschool Initiative.
Margaret, thank you so much for mentioning that. I think one of the things we fail to do when we talk about this is we tend to talk about the populations who are at risk and not the broader question of the ways in which allowing those populations to remain at risk puts Virginia at risk. That we hear a lot of talk about the availability of a good workforce in Virginia and the importance for economic development and Virginia's economic security. And I think our failure to bring up the next generation in a way where they have promising futures and can be contributing members to the Virginia economy and the Virginia workforce is very important. And I'm sure something that you're bending the ear of legislators about on a regular basis.
Absolutely. VPI, also home visiting programs like Healthy Families and CHIP that you're probably familiar with. Those have been on the chopping block as well, and those are programs that come into families with newborns and young children.
Remind us what CHIP is, if you would, Mark.
The Child Health Insurance Program.
Actually, that is one version of CHIP. That's SCHIP, which is a health insurance program linked to Medicaid. This CHIP of Virginia is actually comprehensive Health Improvement Program, which is a home visiting program.
Right. And the nice thing about that is it does many of the things that help bring families into practices that will improve the health outcomes of their children and defray costs, keep costs from occurring because of good practices in the home.
Absolutely.
I would add another program, too, that we neglected to mention. It's WIC. That's Women, Infants, and Children, which actually targets pregnant women, providing important nutrition assistance for pregnant women and their young children, which has many people have said have been a very successful program.
Margaret, you've often been on this show talking about mental health issues because that's one of the big things that your organization works on as far as children are concerned. And one of the things that I've learned about you is that you are so good at putting this in personal terms. When we talk about statistics of who's poor and how many are poor and what demographic trends are related to poverty and what regions, I wonder sometimes if the face of what it means to be poor gets lost. So I'm just wondering if you have any stories about families struggling because of low income that you might be willing to share.
sort of along the lines of the stories you've given us in the past of people who are dealing with a child that has a mental health challenge.
Well, absolutely. And I think we can put it in a place even when we look at the places in Virginia that have the highest child poverty rates, the very highest one being Danville City, followed very closely by Petersburg City. There are also places in far southwest and urban areas like Richmond. But if you can pick one of those places in your mind and imagine a young family, teenage parents even, who have a young child, those are the kind of families that a CHIP or a Healthy Families Home Visiting Program will come in and hopefully get with that family while the mom is still pregnant and provide some prenatal advice and counseling and make sure that mom is getting prenatal care. But we'll also come in and actually just watch the family and help as they care for a baby, young child. Anybody who's had a child knows how stressful that is. And if you can just imagine that in addition to caring for a newborn and not getting a whole lot of sleep, you also are not sure if you have the money to pay the rent or go get the nutritious food that you need.
So in dealing with these families, can you tell us anything about what you've heard from them about what access to some of these different social safety net programs mean?
Oh, it's life-saving. It's completely life-saving, and it helps keep their families together. Another program that I haven't even mentioned that I think is so vital to helping families move up and out of poverty is the Child Care Assistance Program, which provides child care subsidies. So again, this family, the child's a little bit older, the mom's going to work, and it's very difficult to find affordable child care. Subsidies, when they're available, and they're often long waiting lists, but subsidies help provide the difference between what the family can pay and what child care actually costs.
And whether that parent
that
can
Meredith
hold a job.
Said before you called in, is that people who haven't experienced poverty themselves often have misconceptions about who's in poverty and who these people are. So before you go, Margaret, I'm wondering if there, based on all of your experience of interacting with such families, if there are any misconceptions that you've come across that you'd like to address.
I think we always are fighting the stigma. I think poverty has a big stigma, and people assume somehow that people who are in poverty or might be lazy, might have done something to get themselves there. But I think when you, especially when you look at the numbers of poverty, kids in poverty, just since the recession started, we have an additional 33,000 children who have gone into poverty since the economic downturn began. And, you know, any one of us losing our job because of the recession, it wouldn't take too many months before we blow through savings. And if you're starting from a low point socioeconomically, mm-hmm. you don't have a lot of cash reserves, you lose your
right.
job, all of a sudden everything starts to unravel and fall apart. So I think
right.
there's this misconception that people might have done something to deserve it.
And
I don't think that's true at all.
Right. And we were alluding to before that this poverty is a fairly common experience. Meredith was mentioning the stats for a person's lifetime and that a majority of us will actually fall below these poverty thresholds. And a lot of the times that is a one-time experience and nothing to be terribly concerned about sometimes, but sometimes it is chronic.
And Margaret mentioned a very important point about people not having reserves to keep them from falling into poverty, but many of these means-tested programs won't allow the accumulation of a lot of reserves and still have the
exactly.
family eligible for the programs.
That's true.
So, we
so
can't
it sounds
really...
like it may be time to also look at solutions. Margaret Nimmo Crow from Voices for Virginia's Children. So good to hear the sound of your voice. Thank you for taking the time to call us.
Thank you.
We're inviting anybody else who's listening, who has questions or comments about poverty in Virginia to call us. We'll be back in 1 minute. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. I recall more than 20 years ago being startled to hear a college history professor talking about how poverty could affect the human brain. He just mentioned in passing how children who did not get enough to eat or the right kinds of foods to eat could end up with problems in key stages of mental development. Frankly, that was something I never thought about before. So I'm curious. Have you ever had a startling insight into what it means to be poor? Willing to share that insight with us? 888-967-2825. Next to Harrisonburg, Elizabeth, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for Dustin Cable and or Meredith Gunter, please.
wondering if you guys would be willing to share what you know and or think would be good policy in terms of the role of education as not explicitly part of the safety net, but it seems to me that it's very, you know, public education is a very solid anti-poverty program, among other things, and that currently access to quality education, both at K-12 and certainly at university level, is unfortunately closely associated with parents' income. So I was just wondering about what your thoughts and knowledge were about that.
Dustin?
Well, from history, we do know that education is tremendously important. The most famous example in pretty much reshaping our society and keeping people out of a bad economic situation has been the GI Bill. When veterans have come home after World War II, they were given educational assistance to get an education and get back into the workforce. And that has had a tremendous impact on how we approach how we approach the problem of poverty in terms of public policy.
And Elizabeth, certainly our nation's support for public education really is an investment in not only an informed citizenry, that is people who are able to vote and participate in the democratic process in an informed way, but also people who are able to realize their potential and contribute back to society and to our economic well-being.
Elizabeth, did you have a specific thought about where you're feeling education is not doing what you want it to do?
Yeah, I guess it seems to me that access to even great education at, you know, the elementary level is unfortunately really tied to current families' current economic status, and that although I know education hasn't been listed by you guys as part of the sort of explicit social safety net, it seems to me that it would be like a way forward, perhaps, for addressing, you know, sort of as a preventative measure, if that access were better, were more universal, yeah, or closer to our ideal. I don't know.
Yeah, I would agree that education assistance programs are an important component of the social safety net. We specifically don't delve into them in our research papers, but programs like Pell Grants are very important in helping low-income families send their kid to college.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing your perspective.
Yep.
On WMRA.org, if you go to WMRA.org and click on Programs and then click on Virginia Insight, you will see today's program listed as Virginia's Safety Net. And in that listing is a link to the new research report that we've been discussing titled Virginia and the Social Safety Net. So you can read that full report online. Or even better, you can talk to one of the authors of this new study right now, Dustin Cable. Also with us, one of Dustin's colleagues from the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center, Meredith Strome Gunter. We're not getting the difficult questions that I was expecting some of our more conservative listeners to chip in with. So I'm going to ask some of them.
Okay.
What's the connection between immigration and safety net use?
So, yes, demographics, particularly in immigration, do play their part. But it's also important to remember a lot of the eligibility criteria for some of these social safety net programs doesn't apply to non-citizens. So when we're talking about Hispanic individuals crossing over from Mexico, a lot of these non-citizens are ineligible for some of these programs. Some of these programs, not all.
Are there programs that you know of that you don't have to prove that you're a U.S. citizen in order to use? I mean, could someone who is an undocumented person in the U.S. access food stamps or TANF or the free and reduced lunch programs in public schools?
The lunch program in public schools, I believe, although don't quote me on this, food stamps also doesn't have a citizenship eligibility standard.
So the argument that some conservatives make that we have millions of people in the U.S. who are here illegally and may be accessing our social safety net programs, how do you respond to that?
I want to first respond to this, that we And during the course of this program, we've been talking a lot about those programs that have been that primarily serve low-income individuals. And that's what everyone is talking about. However, when we're talking about costs, which is what I assume a lot of these questions are coming from, we need to talk about Social Security and we need to talk about Medicare, especially to a certain extent, Medicaid as well. But the large social insurance programs, the ones that don't necessarily target the poor, these are the ones that are spiraling out of control in terms of costs.
And these are the programs also that are entitlement programs. So they're programs that people expect to receive when they reach a certain criteria, like in many cases with Social Security, it's age. And those programs, some of the means-tested programs have dropout points where you can only receive so many benefits and then you're done, or they have a certain timetable, so only so long you can be on unemployment insurance, so many things you have to do in order to continue to qualify. So I think as we look at cutting costs across the social safety net, Dustin's absolutely right. The costs, particularly in Medicare and Medicaid, because of the rising health care costs, are what are presenting the greatest challenge to the programs that we have in place.
Yeah, I love how you mentioned the demographics, but instead of immigration, I would focus on the aging population as the largest contributor to growing costs of the social safety net. This baby boom population is really hitting the solvency of Social Security. And it's hitting Medicare, too. Medicare is getting hit twice, both by the baby boom population and rising health care costs.
Is use of hospital emergency rooms considered part of the safety net?
Well, we didn't factor it into our report, but it certainly is a cost on all of us. And that's the discussion that's being held right now, right, in terms of the
right.
mandate.
What is it about the safety net in Virginia or the nation, and about poverty in Virginia or the nation, that you want people to know that you suspect most people do not know?
Well, I know actually from public polling that most people, when they think of the social safety net and its contribution to our national debt, they're thinking about programs that serve the poor. That is not the case. So the most important thing
What do you mean by it's not the case?
It's not the case because the largest...
It's not the case that what?
It's not the case that the biggest costs of the social safety net are from income, low-income programs. It's from Social Security and Medicare. If there's one point that I want listeners to get away, it's that.
And other misconceptions about what the social safety net is or isn't, whether it's working, not working?
Oh, definitely.
Well, I think that it's obviously working. If you look at, again, those programs Dustin's mentioning, Social Security and Medicare make a huge difference in terms of the welfare of older Virginians right now and of disabled Virginians right now through Social Security Disability Insurance and Social Security Survivors Insurance. So the programs are working. It's just that the costs of those programs are increasing as a result of an increasing number of people involved and of the costs of providing services, especially medical care.
This on Facebook from Carolyn, who says the first rule of government should be to do no harm. With that in mind, should the government allow food stamps to go toward junk food? Is the cure worse than the disease? There's a reason that obesity strikes the poor hardest. In the old days, the poor were the skinniest. Now they are the fattest. That seems to make no sense.
Yeah, I think one of the questions is where, in terms of providing cost-cutting measures and increasing efficacy of programs, we ought to be investing our government resources. I think a lot of people share this view, but the question is, how exactly do you want to be involved in enforcing the expenditure of food stamps and at what cost? And I think ideally we'd all like to get proper nutrition in the hands of people who need it, but the cost of trying to keep track of whether people are buying broccoli or candy bars with their food stamps, I think, is something that might be you might not yield enough benefit to make the kind of difference that the caller is the person who's communicated in is talking about.
Well, again, defending the point of view that we don't seem to be hearing from our listeners today, I recall Many months ago, Dr. Ray Maranda, who's active, at least sympathetic to the Tea Party movement in Charlottesville, was one of our guests, and talking about how much he hates waste in government. And from people who share Dr. Maranda's political point of view, what I've heard so often in the past is not an opposition to giving a hand up to people who have gotten into hard times, but the idea that there are so many government programs where there seems to be a tremendous amount of waste, maybe even fraud, and that it used to be in the olden days that Carolyn's talking about, that we depended on nonprofit charitable organizations, not government. What kind of response do you have to that point of view?
Well, we're really pro waste, actually.
You're pro waste.
No, I'm just kidding. You know, we actually would prefer to see government resources being spent in the most efficacious way possible. And one of the points I often raise is, relates to these rising healthcare costs and the issue that came up in the last presidential election, which was about the so-called death panels, which really was in the context of how do we make decisions about the allocation of healthcare in at the end of life. And this is a conversation that we seem to be nervous about having in our culture. And yet, if you want to talk about actual costs and ways that we need to align our societal values with what our available resources are, that's a conversation where a lot of difference could be made. And it's one that I think we seem to be nervous about having.
Yeah, everyone hates waste. Everyone hates fraud. But in the grand scheme of things, and these are things that Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson have been telling us from the Debt Relief Commission, is that if we take care of these things, it's actually a small percentage of the debt that we're talking about if we solve just fraud and abuse and waste.
Are we at the point, though, Dustin, as co-author of this Weldon Cooper Center published report, both on the status of poverty in Virginia and the status on the social safety net in Virginia, are we at the point where when we talk about a safety net, we're pretty much thinking only of government programs, that we're not really looking at nonprofit efforts to help the needy or church and other charitable groups' effort? Have we reached a point in the U.S. where when we think about helping people, we're thinking about government programs?
Obviously, private organizations and nonprofit organizations are tremendously important in helping low-income individuals. But when you're talking about the problems and the scale of the problems, these big national problems that we're talking about, the social safety net is primarily, yes, these government programs.
And you also have to think about the capacity, again, geography, and the capacity of any area to sustain the kind of either private philanthropic, church-based, or other-based services for an area. So if you go into particularly impoverished areas, you're not going to have the kind of resources locally that will be able to help those individuals. And how do those resources that are available in other areas brought to bear to help bring up those areas where those resources don't exist?
So Meredith Strom Gunter and Dustin Cable, in a little bit more than the minute we've got left, especially for the sake of anybody who's just joined us recently, in the work that you do at the Weldon Cooper Center, I mean, you've already said, Dustin, that by far the biggest social safety net program for the poor is Medicaid. Talk to me a little bit about poverty and children and programs like free and reduced school lunch. How important are they? How much help are children getting? What needs to be done that's not being done?
Right. So there are several programs that target children, as Meredith mentioned before. We have Medicaid for sure, and that's one of the largest. But also a lot of these other smaller programs like TANF, and it's important to remember that TANF is today a very small program compared to the others.
And TANF is what welfare became right after reform in the Clinton administration.
Right. It's colloquially known as welfare.
Okay. Now 30 seconds to talk more about what kids need.
Kids need, that what they need is access to affordable health care. And we do see some of that in the health care reform law with children up to the age 26 staying on their parents' health insurance program.
And they need good nutrition, they need safe communities, and they need places where their parents, they need a situation in which their parents are able to go and work and not put the family at risk. So the kind of child care supports that Margaret was talking about earlier.
Definitely.
Those all matter in helping the well-being of our children.
And mention the website for the Weldon Cooper Center, if you would.
Yeah, these reports and all of our reports are available on the public at www.coopercenter.org/demographics.
And actually, if you just go to coopercenter.org, you'll have access to a whole bunch of stuff.
A whole bunch of stuff, right.
Our guests have been Meredith Gunter, Director of Outreach for the Demographics and Workforce Group at the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center, plus Dustin Cable, a policy analyst at that workforce group, as well as co-author of the new report, Poverty and the Social Safety Net in Virginia. Thank you both so much for making time for us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you'll find a link to the new study that we've been discussing, as well as more information about both of our guests. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.